planning and fiscal policy will come to order. We have an agenda today focused on the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act monies. And we're going to start with a presentation by the commissioner. And I know that he can only be here for a little bit, so I know Mr. Showalter is also going to be at the table. And then there are two agencies that are going to report to us, both DEED and Department of Transportation. Our final testifier today is Mr. Dean from Common Cause on their report on how we are doing in terms of transparency and accountability. So, Commissioner Hansen, would you like to come to the table?
Madam Speaker, seems like just yesterday.
Yes. We're all, a little
and yesterday was raining.
Time marches on.
Yes, a little more tan. Not as tan as Senator Pogamiller. We have, thank you for
my
the
children, Madam Speaker. Hanging out with my children has been a lot more fun, I got to tell you.
That's great.
A lot better than hanging out with each other, isn't it?
All right.
Madam Speaker and members, for the record, I'm Tom Hansen, Commissioner of Management and Budget and the Stimulus Coordinator for the
pull the mic a little bit closer.
For the state of Minnesota. We have an online, or we have a presentation that Mr. Showalter is going to queue up. You also have a copy of the handouts in front of you. We have three basic, you'll see as we go through, we have general background on the Recovery Act. We give an update on state activities that we've accomplished and then coming developments, and then we are open for questions. I want to start by saying that I, in some of the sessions, webinars that Mr. Showalter and I have been at or other states that we have encountered in seminars we've gone to, me in Des Moines, Iowa, and Jim in Virginia, I think that I can say that we are, we've been pleased with that, of the cooperation and the collaboration we've had with you, Madam Speaker, and the legislature on the Recovery Act. You know, other states have collided a little bit and how they have administered this. I'm very pleased with how we have what we've accomplished to date through cooperation and through hearings like this. If you look the key points, the initial recovery dollars have helped the state's budget and economy. You know, the most obvious fact of that is the FMAP money in 2009 helped us balance our budget. You know, from a state budgeting standpoint, we would have been in deficit, but for the federal medical assistance money that we received in our general fund in fiscal 2009, we were able to end the year with a positive balance because of that. Another key point, the dollars that have come in that we have been able to push out quickly, in part because the legislature acted quickly through the LAC process to approve some funds. We got the rest of them approved by the end of the legislative session. You'll hear from the departments of DEED and MnDOT here in a minute, but it has helped us push this money out into our economy. If you recall, we last met late at night on that last week of session, somewhere around circa 11, 12 o'clock, something like that, when we talked about this last. And we reported then that any minute we were going to receive more guidance from the federal government. Well, that took a long time. That information dribbled in, and we are still waiting for key elements, as Mr. Showalter will show here in a minute, on the reporting aspects of technology aspects of how we're supposed to comply with reporting. We have a broad responsibility for many different activities. Receiving a large amount of money fairly quickly and appropriately, generating new levels of reporting and transparency, and complying with auditing requirements. It's an unprecedented amount of money in this short amount of time, and it's an unprecedented and new level of making government accountable and transparent to taxpayers. And it's something that we're going to be working on in the short term and in the long term. If you look at the next slide, all Minnesota's federal funds are reviewed and approved for use by the legislature. If you recall, about half of them were approved through the federal funds process of the LAC, and back in April, the rest were approved by the legislature. The other key point states we only get recovery money after it's been spent. Most funds will be spent over the next 2 years. It's not everything, all $787 million isn't going to come by September 1st. It's going to be meted out over 2 years. And in many cases, like our medical assistance money, we incur the expense first and then we get reimbursed by the federal government. And to date, Minnesota has received nearly $800 million in ARRA funding. First area, just background, I wanted to, I asked Dr. Stinson for a couple of kind of slides on the economy. The first one is, and he's still breaking down the August baseline, but this is the July Global Insights baseline. You will see the most important element is the July is, even though the many economists say the economy is stabilizing and there's going to be positive growth this fall, Dr. Stinson, if you look at what are based on our February forecast, we're still predicting growth below our February forecast. And in the forecast, we predicted and accounted for federal money as well. So I just wanted to have that as a backdrop. The next slide is, and I think you've seen variations of this with our February forecast that Dr. Stinson has had, but it just compares the last number of recessions with the current recession. And for the most, important or potentially sobering fact on here is that for 4 years after the 1980, 90, and 2000 recessions, real GDP, the jobs numbers have really increased. In this recession, it's going to take, economists are predicting it's going to take longer for jobs to get back to the level they were before the recession began. So it's all to say it is still the worst recession we've had since World War II. The next slide, the Recovery Act itself, which passed Congress in February, I thought it was important to have a slide that showed what the purposes are. And the purpose to preserve and create jobs and promote economic recovery, to assist those most impacted by the recession, to provide investments needed to increase economic efficiency by spurring technological advances in science and health, to invest in transportation, environmental protection, and other infrastructure that will provide long-term economic benefits, and to stabilize state and local government budgets in order to minimize and avoid reductions in essential services. So how do they do that? On the next slide, it's useful, and we've talked about this before as early as our first hearings in February, but just as a quick reminder, it's three big pots or three big pieces of all the funding. It's just think of it in the three big pieces. The first is the countercyclical funds, which is the federal medical assistance money and the state stabilization money of $816 million. That is the money that the states receive that comes directly to the states that we use for medical assistance and primarily for education, for higher education, and to a lesser degree for human services. We will have, especially with that enhanced Medicaid match piece, when we do our November forecast, Madam Speaker and members, we will adjust, like we do every forecast, the amount of money we spend on medical assistance. So that'll probably be going down a little bit based on the actions we in the legislature and the economy.
Commissioner, can you hang on a second? Representative Carlson has a question.
Yeah, sure. Madam Chair, if you're taking questions now or if the commissioner is.
We can.
Curious with the reimbursement and the fact that the state has to make the payments first, how that's impacting our cash flow. For example, the medical assistance and so on are pretty large expenditures, so mm-hmm. Where do we stand on the cash flow side of the equation?
Mr. Showalter.
Madam Speaker, Representative Carlson. It doesn't. It is a issue for the state's cash flow, but relatively manageable, simply because the federal reimbursement for those large programs, such as medical assistance, is within the day. I mean, that is a reimbursement flow between the federal government and the state through existing rules and regulations that is very close to instantaneous. The cash flow issues that the state has is more a question of reserve levels, declining revenues, cyclicality of payments, things like that, not necessarily fronting federal funds.
Thank you.
Commissioner, do you want to continue?
The second pot of money, existing federal programs, this is is approximately $2 billion. This is money that doesn't flow to the general fund, so when you think of what our deficit was, this is money that flows to other accounts. The highway and bridges, you'll hear from MnDOT here in a minute, $502 million. Weatherization, which flows to the Department of Commerce, $132 million. The PFA, Public Financing Authority at DEED, $107 million. The Title I special education money for $300 million and employment and training at $73. There are numerous other, you know, almost a dozen or two other smaller accounts that we're also receiving money. In essence, we are simply follow the instructions of the federal government and administer the money as required. And then finally, the competitive grants. This is the three big pots of money. It's the competitive grants that we received the instructions later. I mean, the feds prioritized the first two pots. There are deadlines that we have received and guidance throughout the summer on the competitive grants. So it's, again, still, as I communicated during session, it's useful. If it's a dollar that's coming out of recovery, it's going to fit in one of those three pieces.
Commissioner Hahn, Representative Solberg.
Madam Speaker and Commissioner, in the second category, most of those at least flow through the state of somehow or another, but the
yes.
Weatherization does not. I think it does not go directly to CAP agencies. The state doesn't even have any kind of accounting of it. Is that correct, or do we somehow or another have some kind of a mechanism in place, such as the PFA for the flowage of that, and so we know where it's going.
Madam Speaker, Representative Solberg, I believe that goes through DEED, but if we could defer that question, because they'll be presenting on their programs and how that's managed.
Thanks.
And then finally, before I turn it over to Mr. Showalter, the total federal funding for ARRA. It's an interesting chart because you see that the tax relief, it's something that doesn't touch the state budget but flows right to individuals who receive the assistance. It's a big part of the package. And then when you add in the counter-cyclical funds, the state and local fiscal relief, $144 million, you're well over half before you get to the programs that a lot of the programs that we're talking about at the federal level. With that, that's kind of the broad overview. If there are any broad overview questions, I can take them. Otherwise, Jim will talk about more specifically what we're doing.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Commissioner Hansen, just back to the previous slide quickly. One more. Thank you, Mr. Walter. The last bullet, the competitive grants, did we use any kind of placeholder number for monies we anticipated receiving under the competitive grants as we dealt with the budget challenges at the end of this last legislative session?
Madam Speaker, Representative Coles, no, we did not. It was too speculative. We are, and Jim, I believe we'll get into what some of the planning we've done. We've done a lot of planning and organizing, be it Minnesota as a recipient or other entities in Minnesota, but it was much too speculative to assume and put it into a budget. We'll get our fair share, but we just have to wait and see.
Madam Speaker, Commissioner or Mr. Showalter, then if for whatever reason the state of Minnesota didn't receive any of the competitive grants, it wouldn't change the current budget situation, correct?
No,
I suspect we're going to get them, but if that were to come to pass for whatever reason, it wouldn't impact the state's bottom line today.
Madam Speaker, Representative Coles, we didn't build any spending expectations on competitive grants. What you may, you know, just to give you an example, the high-speed rail, it's about $8 billion, and there's an application for Minnesota to build a line from, you know, Minneapolis or St. Paul to Madison. If there isn't, actually all the way to Chicago, but if we weren't to get federal funds, then that might create a spending pressure from people coming to the state for more of a state portion of that than federal money. You might see those type of reactions, similar with the green jobs or the broadband or any of the others.
Senator Fogelmiller.
Commissioner, just a quick question. Is there any of the federal ARRA funding dollars that the administration, specifically the governor, wishes he had not requested or asked for?
Madam Speaker, Senator Pogemiller, not that I'm aware of. I think the governor's comments that I think are valid, if you look at, and it go back to the chart.
I'm sorry, which governor's comments?
Governor Pelleny's comments. Are you talking about, was your question about our governor?
Yes, yes. Was there any money that we've asked for or signed off on that he wishes we had not asked
no.
for? Okay, that's all.
But I think the his comments and his criticisms are, the overall cost, and that the money is spread out over a lot of different programs rather than more targeted to those job creation activities like construction or, I mean, that's just what he has said. But I think
I've kind of been out of touch for a week or two, so I wasn't even going there. I was just curious whether there was any money that he didn't really think we should have asked for. So, but thank you.
Representative Simon.
Actually, I think future slides answer my question, so okay. I'll pass.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm trying to reconcile the total federal AARA funding, what's up on the chart, with some of the numbers that are in the stimulus funding page right prior to it. Can you help me?
Madam Speaker, Senator, what you're looking here, this pie chart is literally the federal chart taken from recovery.gov. So these, I'm imagining, are in billions of dollars and are talking about all of the states and all of the funds for
and
the United
in
States.
Billions.
Yes, and as opposed to the previous discussions were about the state of Minnesota.
Yeah, if that wasn't clear, this is the total federal money going everywhere in the United States, just to show you.
Senator Clark.
Just going back, thank you, Madam Speaker, Mr. Commissioner. The dollars that we are going to be getting, have you been able to figure out how many jobs we were able to save because of these? I know you just referred to job creation, and obviously we'd love many more dollars for job creation. But between the Medicaid and the stabilization and all of these other pots, how many jobs have you anticipated we've been able to save as part of this process?
Madam Speaker, Senator Clark, and this gets into Jim's portion of the presentation. The number of job creation is a key element of our reporting deadline by October 10th. So, and Jim's going to walk through that in a minute and how we are working to achieve that. But the other piece that I can answer of your question is we don't have to report job creation on the medical assistance piece.
Madam Chair, and Commissioner Hanson, you might not have to report it, but I think from our own standpoint, given the dollars that are involved here and the changes that we obviously have had to make together or separately related to serious services, you know, the impact about jobs that are retained because of this versus public and private would be very helpful, I think, for all of us as we're moving forward. And I think it's important for the public, too, so that they can have some idea how to quantify what these mean, because it's such big numbers, it's hard otherwise to know. And I know Mr. Showalter is very good at trying to figure this out. So it's my question really is a straight-up one, helping us all better understand what the impact of these really have done, knowing that can be hard at times.
Yeah. Okay.
Commissioner, I know you have to go soon, but we are going to have Common Cause before us in a little bit, and there are some concerns about that have been surfaced about the transparency piece of our reporting. And I know this is a very important thing that we talked about. I know that Mr. Showalter probably can answer some of this as well, but you know, just curious if you have had a chance to review the Common Cause report. It was obviously a national report, but Minnesota didn't do terrifically well in terms of the reporting. And are you familiar with the report and the methodology of the report?
Madam Speaker, members, yes, I am. And Common Cause does good work. I think it's, and as Jim will reiterate this in a minute, but it's useful to look at the, there's the short-term, you know, the expectation that we all support and have talked about in the legislative session about making government more transparent and accountable to our citizens and making information more available. And then there is the piece that we're required to do that Senator Clark was getting at, the reporting the actual jobs created and the data elements by October 10th. And then every 10th of the month after a financial quarter, which raises significant challenges for not only the state of Minnesota, but every other entity, in whether it be a local unit of government, a city, or the state. So from our standpoint, our efforts and energies are, you know, are divided between meeting those federal requirements and then also at the same time work. And again, the short term meeting the requirements of transparency that, and that was the criteria that I understood Common Cause to put forward. We had updated it since then to make it more, you know, some of the data elements that they found were more desirable. But I think that it is a something that we is a work in progress. And it is as important to us to have a transparent system that is accountable as well as meeting the federal requirements. And we have taken, with the help of the legislature, and I know particularly Senator Betzold, our accounting and procurement system over a period of the next couple of years will allow us more flexibility, you know, in the long run to develop systems that are going to be more immediately transparent. In the short term, we are working as well, you know, and try to build on the TAP Minnesota that we set up last year and try to make the data a little more intuitive when it's reported to you and to anybody who might want to know.
And so, Commissioner, I guess, I've reviewed the Common Cause report, and many of the elements they were looking for in our original website or our original form of reporting were things about when projects started, contractors, who was awarded contracts. And so I'm sure that Mr. Showalter will get to that in terms of if you have been able to get that data put in there for the public so people kind of understand what is happening, where it's happening, and you know who's benefiting from the dollars that are flowing through, because it is pretty important right now. We have a lot of challenges in front of us, both as a state and a country, and so I think that's an important piece of this, is being able to show people where the money is going, showing where the money is flowing to. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate your discussion of it, and we'll have more of a discussion of that with Mr. Showalter, because I know that he's been very involved in the details.
One other comment, Madam Speaker. I couldn't agree with you more. There were other states that jumped right away in purchasing these packages that allowed for transparency. You know, Maryland has a pretty good website. I know there are others, but they jumped right away earlier than we did. We didn't get our appropriation. You know, what we have done is try to understand what our federal requirements are, and we've been a little more, I guess I feel like we've been a little more thoughtful. Some of these states that jumped quickly have systems that may, that's unclear at this point whether they'll even work by the time the federal reporting is due.
So, Commissioner, actually, let's just for a second stay on that. So are you saying that outside vendors, in terms of your department, has not contracted with an outside vendor to help you do this work? You've handled this in-house at this point, or you have later on gone to use an outside vendor?
Madam Speaker, we have now contracted with a vendor to help us meet the reporting requirements. I'm talking about a software,
right.
You know, be it Microsoft or somebody else who has a pre-designed package that can get plugged, you know, that you can plug right in if you have a more flexible system, and that can, you know, it gives you good graphics and can pull up a lot of this material in a easily readable fashion.
Mr. Showalter?
Madam Speaker, if I could just add, I think the issue of transparency is an interesting one and a good one. The report starts, I think, what's going to be a race that we're all going to be racing for a long time about how to display information that's useful for the public. I don't think we're to the end of that race by any stretch. This is probably the first hurdle, and there's going to be a lot more hurdles to come. We've spent some time trying to think on the back end what our data structures are going to be like, and it's true that some of those transparency, some of those web interfaces, those user interfaces, aren't as handy, aren't as user-friendly as you can find in some other places. I think we would take a look at some of those other websites. When we've been comparing ourselves, we've gone out there and looked at a lot of these other websites. Maryland did a great job. Some other states did a great job. Some others have some great graphics, great presentation values. We were sometimes skeptical of whether the content was quite as it was seen. In some instances, they were presenting estimates that may not have a lot of enduring usefulness. We're not there yet either, and we'll keep on working at it.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Mr. Showalter, to what extent are you cooperating with OET on any of this?
Madam Speaker.
Why don't you say what OET is just for people that don't know what OET is?
Yeah, Office of Enterprise Technology.
Madam Speaker, Representative.
Mr. Walter.
Office of Enterprise Technology is the coordinating body for enterprise technology purposes. They are responsible for the infrastructure and work of making sure that our networks, our information technology protocols are all in line. And almost everything else is also under their statutes, very broad statutory authority and responsibilities. That being said, yeah, we work with them. We try to stay in contact. For the record, though, you know, maps, the budget system, a lot of the data we're talking about are actually in MMB. So they're not exactly experts on our data warehouse. We're trying to make sure that we aren't creating something that will cause problems down the road. But we're also just trying to report off of some of the data that's already within our department. So I guess I want to say, yeah, we work with them. We're in close contact with them. It isn't – reporting isn't necessarily driven as an enterprise view at this point.
Okay.
So, Mr. Showalter and or Commissioner Hansen, are we behind or do we get behind because of a systems issue within our – available technology, or was it a decision based on, you know, not wanting to go ahead and do a contract with an outside vendor on the software piece? I mean, is there some systematic reason that's inherent in the system that we have, or was it a decision, you know, by you, Commissioner, to, you know, or others, in sort of deciding how we move? Because it is, when you look at the report, I mean, there are many other states that have leapfrogged us in terms of how they are presenting information to the public. Things like, you know, who are the contractors? Who won the bids? Where are they at? When does the project start? You know, all those sorts of things. I'm curious, was it a systematic problem or was it a decision?
Madam Speaker, members, I think we have a overall systematic problem that our accounting and procurement system, where we pull this data from, is from 1994, based on COBOL technology, and some of it is dating back to the late 80s. So we have a fundamental flexibility problem with this data that makes it more difficult for us to plug in some of these, difficult to impossible to plug in some of these technologies. I mean, it's easy to, and we have, you know, as Jim said, some of the graphics and things like that. But, you know, what you want is to pull data up that people have confidence in, that it's not an estimate, that it is current data that means something rather than something that's estimated.
I would just add, Madam Speaker, that from the start, the state of Minnesota's approach was really to get some of those projects on the ground. The quickest way for that was a fairly decentralized approach, wherein state agencies took the lead in getting those projects going because they understood the specifics of those projects. In some other states, they send up centralized boards. They may have had a few different challenges, frankly, in trying to figure out how to work through those federal funds agreements, but they would have had the advantage of perhaps having a little bit more emphasis on that central reporting. Our decentralized approach was really trying to get more at some of the delivery mechanisms and how do we meet some of the obligation thresholds quickly and try to use some of those monies really quite quickly.
Just, though, to refresh my memory, I mean, Commissioner Hansen, you were appointed by the governor, deemed by the governor to be the person in charge of this, that there wouldn't be an outside board or any outside involvement. So that was a choice to do it in that regard. And so ultimately, and even in the law, you have the responsibility, just as any entity that spends the money has a responsibility to report. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say, Commissioner Hansen, I'm not sure why all of a sudden this report, which it seems by default is being referred to as the standard, I don't understand that. I actually look at it with a bit of a, I guess a little trepidation when it starts out referring to conservatives who oppose the stimulus plan from the start are now loudly proclaiming the act a failure. On page 9, that suggests a certain partisan aspect that I don't think is appropriate. I'm interested to know, even this report that I have some concerns about shows Minnesota, under their analysis, is tied for 16th in terms of the reporting. I'm a little confused. Are we meeting our obligation, or are you just pointing out where we're at in the process and we're finding ways to improve it, make it more transparent, make it more accessible. Is that what we're doing?
And I don't have, Madam Speaker, Representative Emmer, I don't have the report in front of me. It's a snapshot in time. And again, as I said at the beginning of my remarks, there's the reporting aspect that you have to report to the federal government, pulling all the data, determining what a job is, having the software that does that, and meeting the reporting requirements. There is the increased auditing and that we're going to have to, you know, with recipients and subrecipients to make sure that the money is being not only spent appropriately but reported appropriately. I mean, that's a deadline that's staring us right in the face now in about 5 weeks. Then there's the transparent piece, and it wasn't because the federal government passed something that said we want you to be more transparent. It is something we have been in broad agreement that we want to make our systems more applicable to our citizens. But it's an ongoing process, and there was a snapshot in time, and it happened to be in the case of Common Cause, the snapshot that occurred before we upgraded, put some new graphics and some of the things they discussed, we ended up putting up on our system shortly after that, and we had been testing. So they're there.
Madam Chair,
can I just point out that we're actually ranked 34th. We're tied for 34th in their overall ranking, and we're actually 45th in terms of the highway reporting. And obviously we could quibble about the perspective of Common Cause, but I do think it's one of the only places we have some comparison data state to state about how reporting is happening. And when you look at the report, I don't know that you and I mean, maybe we would disagree that citizens should know who's being awarded contracts, when the projects are starting. I guess I think giving citizens that information is an important thing. I think you might have been looking at the score versus the ranking.
Madam Chair, I absolutely was. I was looking at 16 tie in the last But here's what I got with just quickly skimming it, and I'm not here to quibble about Common Cause. I think I know who Common Cause is. I'm here to say that I hope we're not using this report as a standard that we're going to measure our state against. And I read it quickly, and it talks about some neat bells and whistles that we're supposed to be doing on websites that not everybody looks at. And I know we get to hear from MnDOT today, and I'm looking forward to hearing about when we rank so lowly or so low on this highway thing. You know, I've been driving the roads of the state just like you, Madam Chair, for the past several weeks. And I can't believe the amount of money we must have spent on those crazy signs that say this is another project that's being built by the Recovery Act dollars. And I'm guessing that is not included in here at all. So I think we've really got to look at this for what it is, and I'm happy that we're at least getting the information so we can find where we're at.
I think our look at it is that MnDOT, Madam Speaker, is tied for 16th.
Right.
You're right. The score is 45. So MnDOT, you're doing a better job, but...
So I was right?
You were right on MnDOT.
Oh, I was right. I want to mark this down on the transcript.
Right.
A broken clock is right twice a day.
I was correct. Thank you.
Even a blind dog finds a bone once in a while.
When you look at, you know, where we're benchmarking things, and there's going to be more analysis done of how this is being done out there, but we don't have a lot of information about how other states are doing it, other than to look at where there's some gathering of data. And when you look at what Maryland has done, I mean, what Maryland has done is impressive. And, I guess if we were in the top 10 overall, that would be terrific. I think we would be probably pretty happy with that. We've got a ways to go, and it sounds like you've done some updating, and we'll hear about that. Yeah. It's just that the commissioner has to leave, Representative Emmer, and so I think, you know, you are ultimately kind of the responsible party with the governor here, and so we want to make sure you had an opportunity to discuss.
Madam Speaker, in regards to transparency, it is as Jim said and referenced, it's a race now. Just, you know, everybody's eager. It's a race we started, you know, because of some of our antiquated system, we started a little behind some of the others, and I think that's the...
And Commissioner, that's what I was looking for. I mean, is there a systems issue here? Is there, a problem? And we kind of knew some of that about our overall system of budgeting that we needed to upgrade, and that's why the legislature worked with you and the governor signed the bill to provide the dollars to make sure we're doing that upgrade to the system so that we can pull this data out in a faster way that's more useful to decision makers. So I appreciate that, and that's why I asked the question about whether it was more systematic or if you had the ability, would you have chosen something different? And it sounds like had the capability been there, we may have chosen a different path in some of this.
Madam Speaker.
Representative Solberg.
Madam Speaker, I noticed later on you're going to be talking about the website, and so I would like to defer my question until we get to that, even though we're talking about it now. But.
Yeah.
I do have some concerns about the website after we get to that particular site.
Commissioner, I don't know if you want to excuse yourself, and we'll have Mr. Showalter take over. I just don't want to keep you there if you need to.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I will see you tomorrow morning. We are both speaking at engagement about this very topic. So.
But remember, I'm speaking after you.
All right. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, yeah.
Madam Speaker,
Showalter.
If we continue on the presentation, the other two elements of our presentation are just some specifics on state activities and then also coming developments. We talked real briefly about a couple of different types of funds, the countercyclical funds and the existing federal programs. And I just wanted to draw to your attention or conclude any questions at the end of session that the end of session actions, any changes in federal interpretation don't seem to have changed the approvals that we've gotten either for the countercyclical funds, whether that's FMAP, the stabilization funds, or existing programs. that you know, we've been able to access those funds. We have planned, I think, accordingly, and these discussions were very useful in making sure that we all understood some of the tripwires that the federal government may have had. I think also one of the things that kudos to a number of the state agencies in doing is just very quickly and very diligently trying to figure out what some of those requirements were going to be for the Medicaid matching funds, things like that, so that we don't have so many surprises down the road. Looking at the Minnesota estimates of Recovery Act dollars, you see about $4.7 billion in total funding. These would be over the entire period of Recovery Act funds. And you can see the distribution here between some of the major areas, from public safety on down to health and human services and other supports. That last category, of course, does include the additional Medicaid matching funds. Beyond that, a number of these areas have some stabilization dollars in, and then, of course, all of the existing federal grant programs. Some of that money is already flowing to Minnesota. About $830 million has already been spent. A large chunk of that is the increased Medicaid match, which directly helps reduce the state effort for our medical assistance program. In addition, another early and large component of the state to draw on RO funds has been Department of Transportation contracts, and subsequent presentations will give you more details about that. Other processes are in flowing already, where we're starting to encumber the funds. We're starting to get those grant agreements lined up. That includes in the weatherization program, the clean water, clean drinking water programs, and other areas where you're seeing federal grants being let to the state. We're now in the process of getting that money either to the local units, to nonprofit organizations, whoever those sub-grantees or recipients might be.
Mr. Showalter,
just a technical question. I've got an 8-18-09 document where the numbers don't seem to be quite up to those numbers. Is there a later document here?
Yeah, that number on this slide changed between the last couple of days. So, yes, this is an updated number. The number that you have should have add up to it just a little bit south of $800 million.
Right. Is there an updated version of this document?
Yeah, I've got your version here with me, too, but I'll get you the updated one.
Okay.
Mr. Showalter.
Here's just another depiction of how that progress has been made over the months since April. You'll see early expenditures and draws have consistently gone up with each ensuing month, and I think you should expect that this will continue to grow and grow fairly rapidly over the next year or two. The bottom part is the blue portion of this graph, shows you the expenditures. That's literally the cash that the state has spent, been reimbursed for from the federal government. That's the cash that's out in the economy due to Recovery Act authorizations. All of those authorizations and all of the obligations that you see here are pursuant to legislative authority, either statutory or the federal funds review process that we went through last session. The obligations, the top part here, are monies that have been already identified. There might have been contracts that have been already set up, but the work either hasn't been entirely done or it's being reviewed or in some way is in process so that the cash has not gone out the door. If you're looking at an impact for the economy, I would suggest both are a reasonable estimates because people are doing the work prior to the cash going out the door, but you can look at it both ways.
So, Mr. Showalter, is it would it be reasonable to read this chart that then the upper part, the obligation part, becomes an expenditure in the following month or months when the work is actually completed or under contract? Is that correct?
That's exactly right, Madam Speaker. Okay. The caveat I would give you, though, is in some large infrastructure projects, the Department of Transportation, an example, you might start to encumber or obligate work on a bridge, for instance, but that may take a while to do. So it depends on the program that you're talking about.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Pogue-Miller.
And Mr. Showalter, the numbers in the charts you've been talking about here are only 2.6 or 7 billion of the 4.8, because there's 2.2 billion in revenue that is in unemployment insurance, tax breaks, and other things. So we're really only talking about half of the money here on these charts. The other 2.2 billion will not flow through the state government.
Madam Speaker, Majority Leader, the tax breaks is where I would pause because the tax breaks weren't included in that $4.7 billion figure. That was really more a direct spending figure. So the tax breaks would be additional money on top of that to the state.
With that caveat, this chart only reflects the 2.6 or 7 billion. There's 2.2 billion outside of this still. That's in unemployment insurance and other things. So.
Yeah, someday, Madam Speaker, someday I would expect this chart to grow somewhere to the point of $4.7 billion. I mean, we would probably at some point start to show the UI funds or try to get that so those figures start to sync up. But you're right, the UI figures
Are not on this. Okay, I just wanted to clarify. Yeah.
Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Showalter, and this is probably a question for Dr. Stinson, but if you know, I think it'd be helpful. The economic impact of the federal stimulus dollars coming into the economy were figured into the February forecast. I guess what I'm interested in knowing is at the rate that it's coming, that it's dovetailing into Minnesota's economy, are we above or below what Dr. Stinson had forecasted in February relative to some economic impact of the federal money? And if it's not fair to answer that, maybe, Madam Chair, maybe we could have Dr. Stinson come in next time we meet. But
Mr. Showalter.
Madam Speaker, Senator Bach, a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I think we should have Dr. Stinson address that of the relative impact of the recovery dollars on the Minnesota economy. I'm not sure how he would answer that. I haven't heard him address that.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Showalter.
To conclude the presentation, I wanted to go through just some perspective of where we anticipate going in the future. Very, very early on, within several weeks after the Recovery Act being adopted, we had a meeting here at the LCPFP in which the speaker asked, tell us what's going to happen in the next couple of months. Give us a roadmap. And that roadmap looked dramatically different than the road we ended up taking. As the commissioner mentioned up front, we thought at that point we were told that we would be getting guidance on the data requirements within about a month, that we'd be doing a practice run on the federal recovery reporting by July 1, that we were all go all the time, and that was where we were going to be. And that was good. The road we took was also an interesting road, too, but it's certainly a longer and slower road. The federal instructions for what data was even going to be collected didn't come out till late June. We just got the data sheet in August as to what specific elements agencies and the state of Minnesota will be responsible for uploading to recovery.gov or federalreporting.gov on October 1. So we're taking a road. It's just looking a little bit different than we had initially anticipated. The competitive grants is the one part that is similar. We knew at the outset, and the federal government knew at the outset, that these were totally new programs, that rules and regulations needed to be defined, that the outcomes and even targeted entities needed to be defined, and that was going to take a while. We're only now starting to get the notices of funding availability. We're only now starting to get some of the specifics so that state entities or non-state entities can start competing for some of these funds. Transparency, a big topic initially, continues to be a big topic, probably even a little bit more of a topic at the state level than initially discussed. Initially, we all thought that recovery.gov was going to retake a lot of that responsibility. And while there was state obligation for showing information, it wasn't quite clear how we would show unique and different information than what the federal website was going to do. Remember, they get everyone's information. They get it all. They've got a very very large and well-funded IT effort to try and put this onto the mother of all websites that will be searchable and provide lots of interesting information. Hopefully that will work. And the question, I think, for state websites is, how do we react to that? Once we know what that website is, how do we position ourselves so that we don't confuse things, so that we add to it and we augment and provide useful, interesting information on Minnesota's position either in the use of these funds, in the targeting of these funds, or ultimately just how government works generally. Our own website, MMB Statement US, was substantially overhauled several weeks ago. We've tried to make it a little bit more easy for user interface, tried to take some of the ideas that we've been hearing and incorporate them into the website. As we have before, we've had summary information on programs available. We've had program descriptions made more prominent, some of the links that we've made to state agencies as well. A lot of those specifics on project information are on those affiliated websites. And you know, I think speak on behalf of MMB and the other state agencies is we anticipate continuing to revise, update, and hopefully build a better infrastructure for state transparency in coming months, really coming years. This is one of the things that Commissioner Hansen mentioned, I think, said. When we talk with other states, when we talk with federal representatives, this is no longer discussed as a temporary state of being. We expect that these types of transparency, these types of reporting standards will be with us for a long, long time. It's not official, but everyone is expecting that while the funding is temporary, the types of reporting, the types of expectations that are being added on right now are likely to remain. Just to give you an idea of how that turns around the equation, typically 45 to 60 days were available for state agencies or local units of government for reporting federal funds. We're now at 10 days with the Recovery Act. So trying to pull that information together in that dramatically a different way with additional information, with different estimates, is going to be it's a big challenge. It's an interesting one. I think it's a good one, but just to help you have it in context as well.
Senator Clark.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Mr. Showalter, I think this is an okay time to be asking, also because you're talking about what you're trying to communicate. Kind of going back to my question from before is estimates of actual jobs, as in headcounts, and how over time people are going to be able to see that. Because as you know, as you're showing, as we're transitioning, more and more money is getting to the economy. We obviously know directly that some of this is really very directly going to be impacting retaining jobs as well as creating. And then I think that, you know, a challenge that we may have, again, and since it's all about helping people better understand, is it looks like they're asking for FTEs, but obviously FTEs can be part-time, half-time, overtime, all of those, as opposed to actual headcounts. How are you either in the process of or how are we going to be demonstrating and showing that?
Mr. Showalter.
Madam Speaker, Senator Clark, great question. I think I've heard a couple of different questions, and if I miss any portion of it, just bring me back. I think, first of all, the data that's required by the Section 1512 reports, which is essentially what the state is legally responsible for reporting back to the federal government, that job count has been a big topic of discussion, and both at MMB, at other state agencies, and across the country. Some of the issues that you've just raised. What does it mean to have a job? I think you know it if you're employed. I think you know you can count in the room how many people are employed, but now you try to start to measure changes, annual effects versus seasonal effects. That gets to be a very difficult definitional exercise. Federal government, I had a long time to try and figure that one out. And if I could paraphrase, there's two different ways to do it. One is a headcount. How many people got jobs as a direct result of money that came through the pipeline as a result of the Recovery Act? So, example, somebody is working on weatherization and helps install some windows at somebody's home. It's a four-day job. They got a job for those 4 days. Was that a job? That might be the only portion time that they were affected by Recovery Act funds, but does that get added to the national total for the year? Or is it an FTE count? How many hours were worked as a result and were funded by Recovery Act dollars? Example there, an awkward and unintended consequence is, well, what if it requires some extra work at a school to do some particular works, and that money was available because of the Recovery Act? They worked overtime to do that. Well, they were already a school district employee. did that mean that there was no extra income, no extra job, or was that some fraction of a job that was added to that headcount? Those are difficult and somewhat insoluble questions. The federal government's largely gone to the FTE route. They're basically asking how many hours, how much money has been spent to support work and get you the FTE count. That's what we'll be reporting through our state agencies, through our subcontractors, to provide a Minnesota-specific estimate, because that's what's being asked. And we don't have a secondary route to get the other information. That being said, Dr. Stinson, of course, will always, and I would expect the economist said Deed, would also look at the overall labor market and from an aggregate basis, rather than a specific basis, but on an aggregate basis, try to make estimates as to what's happening out there.
Senator Clark.
Madam Speaker, Mr. Showalter, thank you. I certainly do appreciate the challenge with that. I guess two things. One is, to date, even if it's just the FTEs, what kind of impact, and both you and Commissioner Hansen have mostly referred to creating versus retaining, and I think it's really important that, at least for all of us, that, and I think you agree with that, that we are able to differentiate that, because certainly we wouldn't want people thinking all those jobs were created as opposed to retained. But I think for our own purposes, our own state purposes more broadly, and for an accountability standpoint, looking at the broader economic impact, those four-day jobs or the overtime, that adds to the economic impact that flows back out. So if there's a way, whether it's just a drop-down menu that somebody is reporting in, and having done lots of reporting myself, working for organizations over time, I know we want to make this simple for people. But, you know, something as simple as how many additional overtime hours, how many seasonal or how many new permanent jobs or how many, whatever it is that we're able to do. And certainly from an internal standpoint, from within state government, I think we're really interested in what you've been able to retain. I remember at one point we had a conversation about would there be new temporary workers hired with recovery dollars on some of the projects versus maybe moving some people around that otherwise would have been laid off. And so I'm not trying to add to the complication here, but I think there's a way to help us better understand what the actual economic impact is versus having Dr. Stinson always having to kind of figure out the equation with maybe not quite adequate data.
Madam Speaker, Senator, I think that's good advice and certainly something we need to strive toward. We don't have any primary information at this point until we get that first report together on the jobs impact. You know, Dr. Stinson has heard anecdotal information like 180 people coming back at Anderson Windows because there's going to be more demand for their product. Lots of jobs weren't lost in the construction area or more could have been lost had it not been for these things. So it is absolutely a case of jobs being retained or reinstated, not just jobs added. And yeah, we'll try and provide the data as best we can.
Thank you.
I'm going to call on Representative Solberg, and then why don't we wrap up with Mr. Showalter and ask the two departments that are going to present today to come up and then get to the final presenter. So, Representative Solberg.
Well, Madam Speaker and Mr. Showalter, we're at the website process right now, and I think one of our goals, hopefully, is to have the common Joe that lives in Grand Rapids or St. Cloud or anyplace else be able to go to the website and say, you know, this is how recovery is affecting this particular area or this particular type of project. But you have contacted with Deloitte, right, to design the map system. Is that correct?
No.
Mr. Showalter?
Madam Speaker, the contract to replace the map system went to a group called Maximus.
Okay, but isn't Deloitte one of your consultants in that as well?
Deloitte is working with, I'm sorry, Madam Speaker, Representative, Deloitte Consulting is working with us on replacing the biennial budget system. We're talking with them about the specific design aspects and have not signed a contract at this moment. For the our reporting module.
So my question is, where are we at with the website right now? And is it user-friendly? Is it going to and this, my second concern is, once this information goes to the federal government, and it'll be your obligations to get it there by the 10th of February. Will we be able to then bring that back to the state of Minnesota and to our specific locations in a reasonable type of search? Have you had conversations with the federal government to bring it back to us so that average Joe knows what's happening in these recovery efforts?
Ms. Showalter.
Madam Speaker, Representative Solberg, excellent question. And I'm smiling because we've had that conversation with our federal counterparts and state counterparts pretty much since March. I can't at this moment give you assurances that we're going to be able to in some way download the Minnesota data from their website. I do know that they intend to display and make their data searchable and easily accessible on their own website. So that is, I think, part of their promise, how we interact with them and
Madam Speaker, will we have a link then to our website to that so that people can follow that?
At a minimum, yes. I think we are going to we're planning for a couple of different possibilities, and quite simply, one stream of it is to capture the initial reporting from state agencies in a database that we will then provide reports or some kind of mechanism for people to get information on what's going on in Minnesota from the state of Minnesota. So regardless of what the federal government is being able to if they're successful, that's great. If theirs is better than ours, great. We'll just do links. If it's not as good, we'll provide that information because we'll have that. The other part that we'll try to provide is up-to-date spending information that's not available from the federal government at any point.
Well, then one quick other question. Obviously, this spending has a great deal of impact on our budget going forward as well. And are you going to be able to integrate this into the budget information that we will receive, going back to some of the original questions that were made earlier? So when we look at budget documents in the future, we're going to have this integrated into our MAP system or our BIS system.
Madam Speaker, Ms. Representative, another great follow-up, and it's probably worthy of a meeting all unto itself. As you know, the supplemental budget document, it really is just any kind of revised proposals to the existing budget. Doesn't provide a lot of background information on federal funds or other funds. That really only comes through on the biennial budget cycle. Where we're trying to move as an organization is find ways to collect and manage that information on an ongoing basis, so it's not a once every 2 year type of discussion. And I think that's worthy of a more extensive conversation about how we get there. So bottom line is, yes, the normal process would have that information all showing up in the biennial budget and documents for fiscal years 12 and 13.
Well, I think, Madam Speaker, my questions are designed to be able to move us forward, like for the next session, because it's extremely important for us as we make decisions into the future as well, based on one-time money and other ongoing type of supports.
Mr. Showalter, something that you answered with Representative Solberg made me think about the local reporting of this, that the folks who are receiving the money locally, it's a little different process for them to report. Are they going to report to you and to the federal government, or is there a way that you're going to be able to integrate the local impacts and be able to show that in the state reporting? Because we've been very focused on just the state dollars flowing, but there's a lot of money flowing directly to local units and school districts as well as local governments.
Madam Speaker, that's right. That's an important point. That's part of the reason why we at MMB, I think most every state representative and delegation has been trying to get and asking for consolidated federal reporting for their state to be available, because very few, if any, states are actually having all of the local information go through a central entity as well. Usually only have that state information, In no circumstances would you necessarily have the federal adjustments that they might have made to jobs numbers, other data corrections that they might have.
And then, Mr. Showalter, one final thing. Enough staff to meet the commissioner's guidelines on the memo in terms of both at an agency level and then at MMB level to process the data in a fast manner?
Madam Speaker, I hope so. This is going to be an interesting run. Unfortunately, the July dry run didn't occur. So we're all doing this for the first time.
Okay.
And I would just encourage this body to understand that this is going to be a process. We're going to a new norm of federal reporting. And we're going to be doing this every quarter for the next 2-3 years and probably beyond that. Part of what you should judge is certainly where we're at right now, absolutely. But I hope you also judge how quickly we progress or don't progress, because that's ultimately how we're going to get to some steady state.
Okay.
Representative Carlson. Madam Chair, I don't know if you could even begin to answer this question, but I'm sitting here thinking and listening to the discussion and the renomination of the Federal Reserve Chair. And he indicated, and others indicated, his challenge very soon is to begin the process of weaning the states from the economic recovery dollars that are flowing in. And what triggered my thought on that was the reference just now to one-time money. And are you doing anything internally in terms of the budget planning process to begin for that, or to begin that conversation, at least, as to what we do down the road?
I think the question might be, Mr. Showalter, are you planning on planning a budget for the 2011 cycle, being the status of the governor?
Madam Speaker, Representative Carlson, I think at this stage, yes, we would typically end up, we'll be starting to take a look at budget options going forward. If you remember the first couple of slides in this presentation, we've been going through a very rough ride in this state and in other states, and the variability of our revenues has almost all been negative, but it's also been highly variable. There have been a lot of surprises, and I think our planning horizon right now is, how are we doing for the next couple of months? What's going on in the economy? Do we know we've reached bottom? And is our forecast starting to track online? I feel almost lucky that despite the budget problems that we've got forecast, some states are still in something close to a free fall, where they're finding current year gaps of multi-billions of dollars, and they're not sure when they can really start to plan much very far into the future. Right now, my personal horizon is, are we getting to a place where our revenues are a little bit more knowable? Do we have the risk management tools? And can then we start to have, I think, a constructive approach to whatever that new normal state is going to be. The stabilization dollars, the stimulus dollars, were helpful in buying this state and other states time. It's going to take several years for all of the states to work through this problem.
I didn't expect that they would reveal a plan here today, but I think the thought process has to begin.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Showalter. I think next up is the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Paul Moe, Department of Employment and Economic Development. I did not prepare a PowerPoint today. I think staff is handing out a brief kind of overview of our stimulus awards to date by program. What I'd plan to
I'm just trying to find out, do we have that? Okay. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Moe.
I'm sorry, it's coming around. It's just an overview of kind of where the department is on several of its programs that we've been funded through the stimulus programs, et cetera. An overview of the purpose of those programs, the award status, if you will, and then an outcome kind of measurement And if the measurements aren't there in numerical data at this point, it's a work in process. These projects are ongoing, and we will continue to gather information, report those. And as you heard Commissioner Hansen and Mr. Showalter explain, this is a work in process. Working with them and their consultants or other professionals to kind of get a consistency and standard of reporting of outcomes for these programs. And also, just to highlight some other challenges we face is we deal with a number of different federal agencies, and they all have kind of different reporting mechanisms, different standards of outcomes or database elements they're looking for in their programs. So we have to meet with those kind of individually. We've had staff on numerous conference calls and webinars and other information to kind of gather that information or have a discussion with those federal partners about what those elements will be, when they're required, and what we're going to track and the frequency. So that's been a work in process since the stimulus dollars were awarded. We kind of have, if I can, two or three several kind of segments or buckets of awards. I'll put them in two or three different categories. One is our Public Facilities Authority, housed within our agency, provides loans and grants to local units of government for various infrastructure projects, the drinking water and the clean water projects. Terry Coleman, our executive director, is here if you have further questions on that. And the expectation is over time is we will be able to drill down on each one of those projects and identify those elements that we're all looking for, and that is who the contractor was, what are the job creation components of that, and other benefits of those projects. So that's kind of one segment, $107 million all been awarded. Much of that's under contract throughout the state.
A technical question. Some others may know this, but I don't. I'm not on finance. Amount awarded versus obligated, what's the difference? Awarded to who? The awarded is to Minnesota, or the awarded is to somebody in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, the column amount awarded to date is the amount awarded to the Public Facilities Authority.
Okay, so that's acceptance of the federal
dollars. Acceptance of the federal dollars.
Okay, so then the what would be the reason that the unobligated amount would not have happened yet? We just haven't gotten it through the pipeline, or we don't have enough applications?
Mr. Chairman, those would be contracts under process.
Just a very brief, I'm not looking for. Okay.
I do have a list I can pass out of.
Okay, well, I think you should. Yeah.
But unobligated means we haven't closed on the loans. We don't make awards, actually issue a contract until the project's bid. So we've told cities we reserve the money. So the money's all reserved for cities that met the requirements outlined in statute. We had statute change for us to get the money out. And that literally went out in 3 weeks.
So the 30, so just the general, the 30 or this and the 14, there's enough in the pipeline to spend that money. You're processing it still. So it's not like there's nobody out there asking for that $30 million.
Correct.
I mean, we like contracts. That's where I was trying to get. And this gives a more detailed.
Yeah.
Okay, that's all I needed at this point. Others may want more there, but thank you very much.
Another large segment of award was through the unemployment insurance program mentioned earlier. It kind of came in three separate buckets, if you will. We received on May 8th $130 million award from the Department of Labor directly to our UI trust fund. And that was just put in the balance of the fund to pay out to beneficiaries. The other $207 million of UI benefits to us went to beneficiaries again through a series of economic extensions or emergency extensions, 13, 7, an additional 13 weeks of extension. So since last fall or last summer, actually, there's been a series of extensions or emergency extensions awarded to Minnesota, and that has been $207 million since the stimulus passing.
In layperson's terms, when does this run out, this level of money?
The extensions and the emergency benefits expired December 31st, 2009.
And is there an anticipation then that where will that fund be? And some of you are on these committees, you know this answer. Where will our fund be at that moment in time? Is there a cliff?
Mr. Chairman, members, we expect to go into a deficit, if you will, sometime this fall, September, October, and then continue into deficit for some time into the future, based on the current projections.
Okay. How significant of a deficit?
Mr. Chairman, depending upon how far out you go or assumptions used on the extent of the recession, it could be $1 billion. $1 billion.
And is that money that we will participate in or that eventually will be paid for by the federal government?
Mr. Chairman, without federal intervention with paying that back, it will be a tax based on Minnesota employers over time to pay back that loan. That money is borrowed from the federal government and then paid back over time.
So what's the likely scenario there, or is it you may not want to go there?
I don't know what the federal government has in
plan. You know the history. What's the likely scenario? Let's say it gets to $1 billion. Will there be an assessment?
Well, yeah, there's a federal surcharge that's put on payroll.
So that will likely kick in?
That will happen. And it happens frequently, actually.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, correct. Yeah. There is a mechanism in place that will automatically trigger that surcharge.
And could that create a suppression? Is that of the size where employers will really notice that or not so much? What does that do to the overall economy at that point? If it's $1 billion we're talking about, what's the...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know over what period of time it's assessed and paid back by employers, but it's an additional payroll cost is what it is. But I don't know what period of time.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the period of time when that's paid back, but yeah.
Senator Frederickson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just thinking back to the UI program. It also depends on the classification the employer's in, does it not? Yes. Or am I confusing that with another program? Depends upon what the layoff activity has been of that particular sector and that particular company.
Mr. Chairman, correct. That charge is based upon experience rating from employers, some employers will get charged more.
And I don't mean to sound naive, but Senator Bach and those of you who know understand this, is that like real money, that $1 billion? Or is that the fund does go in and out like that? Or is that serious?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have a maximum percentage of payroll that any employer pays into the UI fund. And others, there's a formula based on your experience rating, on what your percentage is, and then there's a cap that most construction employers pay. So the fund receives X number of dollars based on the state's overall payroll, and if unemployment benefits exceed the money, the trust fund normally carries a balance. Once the balance is spent down, it automatically triggers a loan from the federal government. And then the federal government imposes a surcharge on Minnesota employers, a federal unemployment surcharge that then the federal government is paid back. What I don't know is over what period of time that money is loaned to us. But this happens, I mean, it's not only in recessionary times. This happens from time to time. It's an automatic mechanism so that unemployment's not disrupted.
And is the $1 billion like a big number when you do have the cycle, bigger than we normally see, or is that... That's in the realm of...
Mr. Chairman, I may ask one of our UI folks to come up and give you a historical perspective. We've been in deficit before, when we were in deficit and how long we were there and then how much we borrowed.
Maybe this is a bit of diversion, so kind of the brief answer. I'm just trying to get a feel for the scope of this.
Yes, Keith Goodwin. Basically, $1 billion in terms of dollars would be less than we had in 1982 in terms of relative dollars over the time frame. As Senator Bach said, this is a funding mechanism we go in and out of quite a bit. So I would never say $1 billion is not a lot of money. It is. But, of course, it does have to be paid back over a period of time. Generally, the tax rates are about every prorated over 4 years so that you don't try and suppress the economy too much. So that, you know, when you have high unemployment, then obviously those charges have got to go back to the employer at some point in time. They don't get hit all at one time. It's progressed over 4 years, primarily to avoid what you're talking about, which is too much suppression.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, kind of to your point, it does also have an impact on state tax receipts because as employers incur higher payroll costs, that offsets what would have otherwise been income that was taxed. So having the additional tax liability on the part of employers reduces their state tax liability to the state also.
Thank you. Continue.
Mr. Chairman, members, continuing on that handout, again, this is just a brief overview of the various programs. We received some stimulus support. Maybe I'll just characterize, starting on the bottom of page 2 through page 3 and 4, some chunk of money from Department of Labor to help us in our workforce centers and other partners with job training, reemployment assistance, those other support mechanisms that we put in place to help people look for work, get retrained for work, and those types of things. And we will measure kind of the people enrolled in those programs, the amount of training provided, and so forth. The other comment I'd like to make, and certainly take questions on any of this, is some competitive opportunities. We'd mentioned that earlier in one of the slides from MMB. I've mentioned a couple that we are working with our partner agencies on. One is some green jobs. That kind of comes in two categories. One would be some work that we are working with MNSCU and some other higher ed entities on to apply for some dollars that will help us train or retrain the workforce in the kind of the green sector, the green economy, and those types of jobs. And those would be competitive. We're in process of evaluating those opportunities and working with our partners on that. Also, getting back to Representative Solberg's question earlier about weatherization, there was another component of that weatherization that was allocated to the Department of Commerce, Office of Energy Security, and had to do with awarding projects that are renovating their buildings for energy efficiency components, so they can make an investment in their building to make them more energy efficient. And I don't remember the dollar amount. It was maybe $2 or $3 million. And then there was another component with the Office of Energy Security where there is, again, a competitive grant cycle that we're working with them on, where individual companies can apply for grants that are manufacturing renewables or other energy-efficient components. So you may have a manufacturer that is making a particular product or component that is helping with energy efficiency, and we will work with them on making some of those dollars available, making it that prospective applicants aware of those programs and apply for those. So some competitive programs that we'll work on with our partner agencies. To answer Representative Solberg's questions, my understanding is all that weatherization money is allocated to the Department of Commerce, Energy Security, but then it's reallocated back by formula to the CAP agencies.
Who is responsible to report then in the reporting of that? Does it come back through DEED?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, I believe those reporting mechanisms will come from the Department of Commerce or their subrecipients, CAP agencies.
But is it a state obligation to report it to the federal government?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, I believe it is.
Yes. I see. Thank you.
Mr. Mull, when you were just, and I know Senator Pogamiller has a question, when you're talking about the possible grant programs and the types of grants, did you specify dollar amount that the state is seeking?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. The recent legislation allocated, and I don't know the dollar amounts in front of me, but there were specific dollar amounts allocated for those two programs that I mentioned that we're working with the Department of Commerce on, their Office of Energy Security. It was either a $4 million program in one area and a $2 million in another one. The competitive nature that has not been allocated by state or by other legislation are some dollars available from the Department of Labor for some training and other reemployment assistance.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Mr. Moe, we have an application in for those dollars right now?
Madam Chair, those applications are pending. We're working with partners and others to get those submitted within the deadlines. And they're coming up, I think, sometime in September.
Okay. Yeah. And can you tell us how much we're going to see?
Madam Chair, I don't know how much we'll see, okay, but we'll certainly be aggressive in our application.
Senator Pogamiller.
Mr. Moe, just quickly, I was looking at the unobligated balances, and I presume the Small Cities Development Program one is the previous answer. There's money in the pipeline you're just processing, or is there something else going on there?
Mr. Chair, the contracts are all out. They're in
so
process.
You just haven't finalized
them.
Okay.
Finalized them, that's correct.
How about the I'll come back to that one. How about Voc Rehab? There's quite a bit left there that has not been obligated.
Madam Chair, Senator Pogamiller, that's the same scenario where those they've identified the recipient.
Okay.
We're just under contract, and it takes time to expend those dollars.
And then the last one is the administrative modernization. None of that has been obligated yet. What's going on internally in the department?
Mr. Chair, that's a couple of things there. One is we've added some additional staff in our customer service centers to help people with unemployment claims. In addition, we are ongoing system enhancements to our technology with a number of state and federal nuances and law changes, we've had to implement those in our system. Some of those are under contract, or I should say we're under review with a vendor for a contract, and there's some other projects that are kind of ongoing. And that number is a little old, and we will get those updated.
Okay, so we should not be concerned that nothing's obligated there yet?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Okay.
Mr. Moe, is some of that going to fix that problem we're having with the unemployment insurance system here?
Madam Chair, we have are serving, as you know, a substantial number of customers. 170,000 individuals a week are requesting benefits, and we have the systems in place and staff in place to accommodate those. I think our average wait times are 2 to 3 minutes on our telephone inquiries and service.
The online systems?
Madam Chair, those have been, I mentioned earlier, kind of ongoing. Every quarter or so we make enhancements, and I think those systems are getting improved.
Okay. I keep hearing about them, Mr. Moe.
Okay.
All right. Anything else? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Department of Transportation.
They made some news yesterday, huh?
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott Peterson from the Department of Transportation, and I have with me John Chiglo, who's our statewide manager for our American Recovery and Reinvestment Act spending, and he's going to be doing a presentation, and I'm just going to stall a little bit while he gets his presentation queued up.
He gets all the hard jobs, Chiglo.
As you may recall, the funding for transportation under the ARRA program came in a few different forms. There were some funds like those for airport improvements where the Federal Aeronautics Administration actually selected the projects within the state of Minnesota for spending. There are competitive grant programs within the spending bill as well for passenger rail and for a program called Tiger. And then there was a direct allocation of funds to the states for road and other surface transportation improvements. And so there are some funds that are certain, and we have a plan in place to spend them all, and there are some where the amount of money that the state of Minnesota might yet receive is still uncertain. And with that, are you ready to go, Mr. Chiglo?
I'll just start talking, Madam Chair, to the presentation you have in front of you. The one thing
that Senator Pokemiller says, you get all the hard jobs.
Let's hope this isn't too hard today.
All right.
And has
done well doing the hard jobs.
Absolutely. My speaker, my children still, every time we go across the bridge, they like it. Thank you.
Madam Chair, John Chiglo with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. In the handout that you have today, there are more slides with more detail. I'll kind of skip through that in the interest of getting through this quicker. But feel free to ask any questions. There's other people here from the department that can give more detail if necessary. The Tiger grant process is also a part of the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and there is $1.5 billion available on a nationwide competitive process. And we have been working with our state and local units of government and along with our districts and solicited for projects within our department to identify projects ultimately that would be the best applications to move forward as part of this process on a nationally competitive process. It is eligible for all modes of transportation. There are limitations from $20 million to $300 million. We've ultimately selected five projects for the department or MnDOT to submit. There are approximately 30 projects across the state that are being submitted by other entities that are interested in these funds. The five projects you see there are the BNSF Third Main Line. It's adding another more capacity for improving congestion. There's adding overpasses at some intersections in Anoka. And it's adding going to be adding additional capacity for North Star and other elements in that corridor that could be benefited by the use of that additional capacity. The St. Croix River Crossing project is another project that we're submitting The first project is approximately a $100 million grant request. The St. Croix River Crossing project is a dual application with Wisconsin, and many other partners have expressed their support of that project, and we will be submitting that project as the primary applicant with Wisconsin as a partner in that process. That is a $300 million grant request. The Duluth Intermodal Project is in partnership with the Duluth Port and the City of Duluth. It consists of improvements, about a $40 million improvement to the Duluth Port, with city street improvements and highway or Interstate 35 improvements all collaborating into one grant application. The multimodal elements of all of these are very beneficial. The multi-jurisdictional between the states is something that they are asking to have in place. In all of these jobs, they're also very interested in contributing and really finding gap funding for these projects. They're not are being looked at with giving. They are giving more preference to gap funding versus fully funding through the grant process. So we're working very hard with our partners to try to find ways to commit funds if and when we are selected on any of these. The Southern Rail Corridor is a little different application. It consists more of a planning application, funding for the planning and environmental review of the application. It's formerly the DM&E bypass. It has some elements associated with this application, but it is not consisting of the construction of the elements. It's more about the planning and looking at the environmental effects of that project.
How much is that?
It's about $21 million. Okay. And the 494-169 Highway 13 and 101 interchanges is our fifth application. That will be over $100 million. I believe it's right around $140 million in approximate numbers. And that, as you know, is an interchange within our system that can be vastly improved. And reducing our congestion, improving of our freight transportation to and from the Savage Port. And so those two interchanges are being combined to improve the application and make that project more appealing.
Mr. Chigwell, Madam Chair, I hope both of those happen. That's a particular interest. So,
Madam Chair,
Sarah Olson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chigwell, is the 13-101. That's in Shakopee?
That's Burnsville.
Madam Chair.
Burnsville?
That is in Savage.
That's in Savage.
Yes. Highway 13, Highway 101, yes.
So 101 crosses at the river crossing when it hits 13 coming east and west?
No.
Or where am I?
Madam Chair,
where am
this,
I wrong on that?
This is on Highway 13. If you are coming east on 169 or north on 169 and take 13, you'll quickly encounter the intersection of 13 and 101.
So 101 is, it's not the 101 I'm thinking of then.
It's Highway 101, which eventually turns into a county road, and it goes into Shakopee.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Senator Pogemiller has a question.
Chigo, you said this is gap funding. Does that mean, for example, in the St. Croix, the request is for $300 million, which is the gap? Or is the request for, it's a $300 million project, and the gap is smaller than that?
Madam Chair, this is, as everybody is aware, been in the press here recently. This is a very large job. It's part of our Chapter 152 program. And we are looking at a $300 million maximum request and grant to fund a portion of the project.
How big is the project?
It is over $600 million.
Okay, so the numbers you just gave us is the gap amount that you're requesting.
Is
the
gap. Well, it's the maximum application amount.
I got it.
But it, yes, it, in essence, it's a gap.
That's an expensive bridge.
Oh, Madam Chair,
where's this coming from?
Representative Carlson.
I'm just kidding. When you talk about the total project, does that include funding from Wisconsin?
Madam Chair? Representative Carlson, yes, it does. Wisconsin is also looking at financing and advancing of funds to pay for their elements of this project as well. So that $300 million is a portion. Some of that would go to the Wisconsin portion of that project.
Okay, Representative Solberg.
Where is and have they been programmed for the rest of the funds? Where are they coming from, and are they programmed? In other words, the Southern Railroad or the 494, 694 project, that's 140, 169. The gap is 140. Has the rest of it been programmed, and where is that money coming from?
Madam Chair, for that particular project, the region has committed $35 million, and the locals are contributing $8 million.
The region is MnDOT?
Region is Metropolitan Council region.
Okay, and the rest is where?
$8 million is coming from the cities that are a part of that project. So that is the contribution, and the gap is the remaining funds needed to construct both of those projects.
Thank you.
Mr. Chiglo, that, in that case, that's probably Bloomington, Savage.
Madam Chair, yes. With the 101 project, 101 and Highway 13 intersection improvements, it is Scott County. Mm-hmm. I believe
Hennepin County, then?
Eden Prairie, Bloomington, and Edina are the three cities that are impacted at 494.
All makes sense.
The high-speed intercity passenger rail program is a process that we actually were working very feverishly on this week. We've submitted two applications. You can see through round one, track 1, 3, and 4 applications due on August 24th, and I'll have to ask for assistance if you need definition on track. We have no track 4 applications, but we did submit two applications. The NEPA for the Milwaukee Twin Cities leg of the high-speed intercity rail, passenger rail, and then the St. Paul Union Depot renovation. So they were submitted on the 24th. Track 2 for the first submittal is due on October 2nd. We will not be submitting on that first submittal. We will be submitting on the second submittal of the Track 2, and those submittals are shown. The remaining three at the bottom will be submitted in April of 2010. Other modal elements, the Twin Cities MPO, we received, as you saw with the MMB, we received about $623.25 million in funding. $73 million went to the MPOs, $19 million to the Greater Minnesota Transit. The majority of these funds were used for buying or purchasing buses, and you have details associated with that in your handout. And there was some money used for transit facilities to build three new rural transit facilities, partially fund the Rochester Operations Center, and improve and expand three existing transit facilities. So there is a wide array of use of these funds. In addition, some of these, I believe, are used for operations. The aviation, we received $23.2 million. It was more than any other of the other states in our region. And I think that's generated some questions from some other states, but we've been very beneficial. There's a list of the projects that money has gone to, rehabilitating runways, rehabilitating aprons, constructing new terminals, and that list is in your handout as well. Passenger rail, we've talked about, and freight. There are three freight projects as part of this stimulus program. This money has come from the $502 million that has always been looked at as highway funds. In the final version of the bill, the freight component was combined with the highway funding allocation or appropriation. So the three freight projects were committed funds from those $502 million. The Duluth Port improvements consists of about $3 million to reconstruct the storm wall, a retaining wall, which is in Lake Superior. The Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Authority received $2.5 million, and the St. Croix Valley Regional Rail Authority for a reconstruction of a bridge to restore service to Pine City is receiving about $750,000.
Madam Speaker, should we be concerned that they combined those two funds? Is that a long-term warning, or was that a good thing for them to do that this time?
Madam Chair, that, I think, caught a lot of us by surprise. It's more modes have to fight for the same pot of money.
So long-term, Madam Speaker, long-term, that might be a bad thing that we just saw happen?
I think we would prefer to see dedicated funding to each of the modes.
Thank you.
This is just a slide just reminding you of how the money was broken out in that initial $502 million allocation. $150 million went to the locals, which is approximately 30%. You can see how it was broken down by population. The state discretionary money, $336 million, was the money that MnDOT has been committing and obligating to our projects. And then the $15 million in enhancements is something that we've been dividing up between all of the projects that have been identified. You can see how we've been gradually increasing in our authorized amount, and you can see how it's kind of dipped. From time to time, it does fluctuate depending on the amount of the favorable bids that we've been receiving. We will modify our authorization amount depending on a favorable bid or an increased bid. But for all of our projects, I think except for maybe less than a handful, we've had bids that have come in much less than our engineer's estimate, averaging about 15 to 20% below our engineer's estimate, which is good. It allows us to fund additional projects. So currently, we have put out the bid about 120 projects, and this is as of July 30th. So we will be having additional lettings this week, and we have bid 120 projects, total of $321 million. 101 of those projects are under contract. 95 of those projects have begun work, and again, this is as of the end of July. And this has been growing exponentially. At the end of June, we had about 36 projects under that had begun work, and it triples. I suspect that you'll start seeing that. You'll see that trend continue through this month, and once we reach September, the end of September reporting, you'll start seeing that growth in projects that have begun start to decline. 10 projects have been completed, and in our reporting, 2,903 direct jobs have been created. There are multiple ways that we've been working with the Federal Highway Administration, who works with OMB, to discern how we count the number of jobs that have been created. This 2,903 jobs is the number of headcount, is a headcount as of July 30th. Another number that we've generated for the transportation infrastructure is the maximum amount of workers on a payroll in any given time in a month. That number is about 3,446. All of these reports that we are submitting, different entities ask for different information, so there are some inconsistencies in our numbers. But we are submitting this. We're trying to clarify that in our reports so that it is clear and people don't get confused, although it's very difficult to prevent.
Representative Solberg.
No, I'm fine. Okay. I got my
Representative Carlson has a question.
On the contracting, I have a question. I've had some communication with constituents and did happen to attend the meeting the other night. Concern that's been raised is the opportunity in the bidding process for smaller contractors, especially contractors that are representative of the minority community and women. And the feeling is rather strong that they haven't been able to share in those opportunities. And so my question of you is, what is happening in terms of providing opportunity for minorities, women, smaller contracts, or smaller contractors to participate in getting some of those opportunities?
Sure. Madam Chair, we are, when I was working on Highway 212 and most recently 35W, we really were trying new things to try to encourage the prime contractor and help the DBEs have more opportunities for involvement in these projects. And on 35W, it wasn't quite getting to the mentorship level, but we were reaching that, where the prime contractor had the willingness to work with DBEs, put them under their bond at times to give them the opportunity. They really took them under their wing in helping them through different elements of the project, maybe giving them superintendents to help with their that had the expertise of the work to introduce them to new types of work that they could be performing. So there's a lot of different things that we can be doing. And from the 35W project, I think we've been working very hard to try to build from that success and implement those methods that we've learned on many projects in the past in these projects that are in this program, but not only on this program, but in all of our projects that we let. And so I'm very well aware, and many other people are very well aware of the frustrations that the DBE community has with their level of involvement. We are working very hard to enhance their level of involvement on our projects. We are also in compliance with the federal regulations. We're working not only with the DBEs, but the potential prime contractors. We're working with the DBEs and offering them opportunities to be more involved in potentially bidding jobs on their own and becoming primes and having that opportunity expanded for them. So there's many facets of our process that we're working to try to expand that opportunity and involve those elements of the industry.
And Madam Chair, the meeting I was at the other night, there were compliments made about the 35W bridge in regard to what I'm talking about. Apparently that worked relatively well. But just so you're aware that the concern is out there in the community about opportunity.
Senator Paul Miller.
Two quick questions. The 2903 or the 30, whatever the number is, mm-hmm. is that full-time equivalence or is that number of jobs?
Madam Chair?
Or is that the issue?
There is through this whole process, it's kind of been a work in process. And the definition of what they want reported for jobs is evolving.
Okay.
So what you see here is not FTEs. It is a headcount.
Okay.
In a snapshot in time. So that's what this is. Now the reporting that we have to do for October is based on FTEs. And the difficulty in that, because these are direct jobs, not indirect, the difficulty in the FTEs is that we have to report both direct and indirect in October. And the indirect is much more complicated, although direct has its own complexities. The indirect are much more complicated in that when we buy a light pole, every element of that light pole may be assembled in one area, but it might be built in multiple areas. And how do you start? It really starts growing as far as the FTE for indirect jobs. We've been told that the potential is we have to go out and interview folks to discern that number. And that is very worrisome because of the level of involvement that that's going to require.
That makes Representative Emmer's concern about signs look like it's just a tiny, yes. tiny issue. Sarah Pogemiller.
And do you have a way historically of measuring the level of activity during a construction season, either by the number of jobs or the amount of money or the number of projects we're undertaking? Because I'm trying to get a feel for where we are historically this summer or this construction season relative to other years. Are we above, below? Particularly after your report yesterday, I think we need some historical perspective of where are we. Do you know the question I'm kind of asking? Are we, for example, in my neighborhood, it looks like all I have is construction going on right now. But that may just be in my neighborhood. I'm wondering, in terms of total construction and rehab activity, are we high, low, historically? And you may not know that answer right now, but if you could provide us something about that, it doesn't have to be real scientific, but just some sense of where we're at.
Madam Chair, we can give historical levels of spending
which
on a year-by-year basis, but that might not get you
right.
what you want. It might be more valuable if we can work with the industry, and they might be able to provide more, substance to that to answer that
Don't
question.
Don't kill yourself on it, but if you could, I think it would help us as policymakers have a sense if we're gaining on it or headed the wrong direction. Because what we hear from the trades is that nobody's working. And just trying to get a sense in your area of business, where are we?
Ms. Peterson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if I may, the numbers that I've seen that have been produced by members of the construction industry indicate that in terms of horizontal construction or road construction that we are still a little bit below, but not that much below kind of historical averages, if you will.
Okay.
But there's, to a certain extent, the skills and competencies of people that are involved in vertical construction or the construction of buildings and stuff like that are interchangeable, and there the employment situation
right.
is quite different, I believe, in that. The last numbers I saw was there was a, they were well below their historical averages in employment
so
in that.
That is exactly what I was looking for. So even with the transportation bill we passed 2 years ago, a year ago, and the federal interjection of money, we're still at the average or slightly below the average. That's,
Well, one of the other questions that is related to this is, to know what we had planned from the department
right.
for construction, let's say a year ago at this time. What was the planning for the construction?
Oh, it's got to be a lot.
And
more.
What was taken back because of the lack of state funds, and how much has this been backfilled? I think that's what I would be interested in knowing. What were you planning to do without this, and then what did you have to bring back, and what were was able to be brought back by these funds.
Madam Chair, this is all new money, obviously. And so with that new money, as you know, we have a very stacked transportation plan, and based on that's how we go about delivering our projects. And with this new money, we've just like when we get any other new influxes of money, we develop a list of additional projects that we can deliver with that money.
Well, Madam Speaker, I understand that, but a year ago, or when when we were looking at the TAG group, we were able to get reports every month, every time we met, of this is what is being projected from the department to be let in 3 months from now.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the kind of information that would really be interested if we could have, what were you projected to have let? And what did you have to pull back because of the lack of state funds
or the increase of funds?
Increase in funds. That's right.
Representative Solberg, the point here is if you take what we did in TCAG 2 years
right.
ago and the department was looking at, it was a pretty bleak picture
right.
in terms of being able to actually go out and put under contract and put under bid a number of projects. There certainly were projects there. But looking, I mean, what would be most interesting is 2 years ago, a year ago projection, and then what is happening today to see, you know, obviously there are still concerns about the level of employment in the state in the construction industry. I think the question is, in the horizontal construction area, are we, you know, my guess is, I speculate, that we're at least doing much better than we would have been doing without these dollars, without the state transportation bill dollars. We're beating the odds there. It's in that vertical construction sector, and both in terms of, you know, particularly in terms of the private sector building is just, you know, it's dried up, and you don't have people making plans. I mean, I was talking to an architect last week who told me that he has gone from a firm of 35, he owns his own firm, down to a firm of 10 in a year. And so that tells you that the pipeline has dried up for planning as well. And that is a really troubling piece of this, that not only are we just in the sort of, you know, right now people aren't building things, people aren't planning on building things. And so that's a particular problem that we have to deal with. But if you could compare those, you know, and you were all there, I mean, you remember 2 years ago what we were looking at, a year ago what you were planning, you have those same numbers, I'm sure, you know, or the numbers presented in the similar way, and then where we're at now. I think that would be helpful for us to look at.
Madam Speaker, it seems, have in the transportation community, have you, we're going to have the reauthorization, we're going to have the next transportation bill next year, it appears now, if not this year, but maybe next year. Has there been thinking or assessment done of this difference between permanent money versus one-time money? And are we viewing, have you guys been thinking about that in terms of this pipeline that was just brought up? Are we looking at a big cliff, or do we assume that that next transportation bill will be able to keep us at the level we're at? Or is that just an unknown right now?
Mr. Chigwell.
Madam Chair, we have what I guess
I'm talking about the federal transportation bill.
What I would say is we have a contingency in place so that if the federal, we're expecting the federal funding to continue at its current level, but there's also contingencies in place in case that federal funding doesn't exist.
And when you say current level, you mean in the previous transportation bill or at the current level with this new federal ARRA money?
The current level, Madam Chair, the current level, well, based on historical values, not including the ARRA.
Okay. So you're viewing the ARRA as one-time money?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay.
So quick question. How much do the signs cost and who pays for them? I particularly like them. I think it's important for people to know where their public dollars are going, but that's, you know.
Madam Chair, each of those signs, initially when the guidance came out to have a sign or suggesting to have a sign, they were much more elaborate, but they didn't fit our signing and road sign manual guidelines. So we've modified it to the black and orange and the little circle that you see. It is a few hundred dollars each sign, and it can be paid for with these stimulus dollars or state dollars, most likely stimulus dollars that are being paid for.
Are the signs made?
Are they made here?
Yeah.
They are made in the state, Madam Chair, and we felt they're not being placed on every project. They're being placed on in areas where there are large volumes of traffic it really made sense to let people know. We've gotten favorable and not so favorable results from the public, so.
Well, Mr. Chigwell, that's the way it always goes in this work. You get favorables and unfavorables, and people sometimes get a little, you know, when they're sitting in that traffic on 35W, although I check it every time to see if there's any change, I'm sure that you probably get some calls that people are not necessarily happy with that all the time. But, you know what, I guess I all season long have thought, thank God people are working, so.
Yes, Madam Chair, yes. And Those stimulus signs could be looked at as another way of just being transparent.
Absolutely.
And where this money's being spent.
All right. Well, thank you, guys. I think a little follow-up. Oh, are we done? We're not done. We're not
There's,
done at
there
all.
There are just a few more
okay,
slides. I'll go through them quickly.
And then I get Mr. Dean up here.
I apologize for this slide. It's in your...
it's hard to read in the packet.
Hard to read in the packet. We can get you a color copy of this. But what this does is breaks down how the stimulus money was distributed across the state by county. There was some language in the ARRA bill that stated that we needed to consider economically distressed counties when committing dollars to different projects. And so when you look at this, and interesting enough, the Bureau of Economic Analysis says that they lay out how you determine what a economically distressed county is. None of the metro counties are under that criteria economically distressed. So when you look at these dollars, about 25% of the dollars are distributed to economically distressed counties, and that's the solid red counties. The hatched counties are adjacent to economically distressed, and we identified that because a lot of our construction industry is not located local. They're regional within our state with regions. Their workers are commuters. They commute from their homes to the projects wherever they may be. And so we felt that it was important to show how that money was distributed. The highway infrastructure and reporting requirements, you can see all of our, the first three, 1607, 1201, and 1511, were all submitted this spring. You can see the other monthly reports to Federal Highways, the Transportation Infrastructure Committee, and Minnesota Legislature. All of those reports, I know you have another group coming up to talk to you shortly here. They reviewed what our website consisted of. At that time we were developing our website, we hadn't had a chance to really get to a point to open it up for people to use. Over the last month or so, we have that website is now functioning. All of these reports are shown there. The letting results are on that site, a map of the projects, all of the projects that are receiving money with a very detailed description. So there's multiple levels of geographic descriptions of where these projects are at within the state, in addition to numerous other details on each of these projects.
Mr. Chiglo, was that report that came out, the Common Cause report, the national report, and then was specific... some specific ideas about the sorts of things that should be available or could be available or some states are making available. It sounds like that may have been helpful feedback in as your website was being further developed and worked on then to capture that information.
Madam Chair, I think what it did is it pointed us to other states for us to use as examples, maybe not replicate, but use that to generate ideas for our use within our system.
And did you feel like, Mr. Chiglo, that the systems at MnDOT, you were able to work within the system that you had at MnDOT information technology-wise and otherwise to be able to accomplish that then?
Madam Chair, yes, this website was developed within our own research, within our department, and we've used other elements to help satisfy the requirements of these reporting that we had in place and have been using in the past. So we're not only reporting for the MnDOT projects, we're as the prime recipient of these funds, the sub-recipients are the cities and counties and transit agencies, so we are assisting them, and the reporting for those, primarily the cities and counties, are coming to MnDOT for us to report as one large group.
Great.
Madam Chair, if I may, just on that reporting topic, what Mr. Chiglo said is correct, but in setting up a systematic approach to aggregating the information for these reports, I know that there was a lot of effort put into trying to pull information from different management systems within the department in order to collect this information in the manner that was requested, and it was not without a substantial amount of effort, because these systems that are in place were built without this particular capability in mind when they were developed. So,
is the commissioner looking at using this sort of reporting going forward on an ongoing basis, some form of it?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that we've gone down that path yet. Still focused on the immediate task of producing good reporting.
And Madam Chair, I think a lot of this information had already been posted to our site, and what this has done is centralized it into one location. A lot of this information is on our website. If anybody was to go on, it's just not as easy to get to as it is at this point.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And here I just talked about the number of groups. The one interesting one is the Office of Inspector General. There's a great deal of interest, obviously, to make sure that we're not only accountable and transparent, but the Office of Inspector General is very engaged and involved in not only our state, but across the nation. So they will be having a large presence in Minnesota as part of this process. The Davis-Bacon prevailing wage process, we did encounter some issues with Davis-Bacon and the level of the last determination update of wages. So we've contributed some state funds to each of these projects to make sure that the state wage rates have been included in these jobs so that the wage rates were not deficient at the federal level. And then that's it.
I think we've done our questions as we've gone along on this one. So thank you very much.
Yeah,
oh, Senator Pogba.
I think we should say that appreciate the department trying to accommodate the Minnesota's tradition on Davis-Bacon. That I think that's good work by the department. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, Mr. Dean.
Madam Chair.
Hello, Mr. Dean. How are you?
Great. Thank you very much for inviting me to speak.
Identify yourself for the record.
My name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota. I'm pleased here to present on the report that we did with Good Jobs First called Show Us the Stimulus. It outlines basically does an evaluation of state-based websites that deal with the recovery. So starting off, I really think that openness, transparency, and accountability issues are really a bipartisan issue. When the President Obama signed the stimulus package, he talked about the importance of transparency and openness as part of the process. And Governor Pawlenty did the same thing when he announced the creation of the TAP website, which was the state's procurement website. I think it's important to note that when you look at the governor's statement, I encourage citizens to use this website to become watchdogs and help us make government more efficient and effective. And I really think that is critical on why we're pushing these ideas sort of forward. To give you kind of a brief synopsis of the report, what I thought I'd do is kind of walk you through some of our criteria and then from there identify some of the changes that have been made over the last month by the DOT and then also the general RO website and then kind of identify some of the recommendations that we think for the changes that need to be made. So briefly, here's some of the categories that we looked at and why it's important that they you know, push out this information. The first is really categories on stimulus spending so people understand where the money's going, a distribution of that spending really in different parts of the state, and then also how the specific projects are being carried out by private contractors, including the employment impact. And I think that's really important because that was one of the main criteria of why we did the stimulus in the first place. So really the question is, what did the website show? Did they allocate that spending totals by broad categories? Did they show it by different counties? I think as legislators, you'd be very interested in knowing where that money's going. Other aspects is, you know, specific spending of the projects and the contracts associated with them, and then also the contract details, including those dollars amounts. And then lastly, the data on the jobs. So how Minnesota stacked up. On the general ARRA website for the state, we received a 15 out of 100, which was fairly poor. We ranked 34th compared to other states, and here's what some of our neighbors did, Wisconsin being one of the better. However, the transportation website did significantly better, as was discussed earlier. We really applaud BNDOT for the work that they've done. I think they're heading in the right direction with some of the changes that they made. So what does the current ARRA website do for the state? It shows the amount of ARRA money being allocated by program, and then it lists some of the agency data on the website. They've made some improvements. They started to show some of the transportation dollars where they're going, specifically through maps. But even when we reevaluated the site this week, the state's general ARRA website still receives a score of 15 out of 100. Again, I think if we were to we did not rescore the transportation one. If we rescored that, that would have increased a little bit. But I really think that MnDOT, again, is moving in the right direction, and the general state's ARRA website should move more in that direction. So what are some of the recommendations that we have sort of moving forward? We've identified a series of 9 recommendations, and I'm going to start to walk through some of those. So I think the key thing, and this is what California is doing, is really display the totals by category. The state somewhat does that, but not the greatest. And then really allocations compared to the need. So it's showing matched up where the money's going and comparing that to economic data. I think that this is really important to look at because, you know, as was stated in the report, really our objective was to have an evaluation of the stimulus package. How well was it working? And it's really hard to evaluate the impact of that if we don't know where the money's going, if we don't know if it's going to areas that are really in need.
Yep. Can I ask, Mr. Dean, because I'm looking just quickly ahead to see if you address this. I mean, what, you know, I'd asked Commissioner Hansen a little bit about, you know, why not contract with someone who has specific capabilities in sort of helping you off the shelf on this or something like that. And you know, one of the issues is the underlying system of budgeting in Minnesota is kind of an old it probably is a cash for clunker sort of situation where we have decided that we need a new system. But certainly all of these states that have done better and that you're giving us examples of have many different systems that they're using. Any observations from the analysis that's been done in terms of what has really worked here to, you know, put the information together in a usable way for citizens to be able to look at?
I think the first thing is really making it a priority. And I really encourage the department to make it more of a priority. The web is quickly becoming the primary way that citizens get information. I mean, we've seen, unfortunately, the slow decline of traditional media. Media really used to provide that sort of oversight role of government. And now with the cutbacks, which I'm sure you see in the Capitol Press Corps, they're providing less and less of that, unfortunately. And so I really think that we need to find ways to empower average citizens to play that role. And one of the ways is by, you know, developing these type of websites. The federal government has started to make some moves in that direction. I think the state of Minnesota, though, is woefully behind, and it's something that needs to be more of a priority as we move forward. The second thing is regarding the software. There was actually some national groups that developed some of these aspects of the software for free and made it available to every state. Yes.
So and say more about that.
Well, this is from some of the national group that we worked with. They I can't remember the name of the exact organization. I talk about this a little bit later. But they provided a GIS sort of platform that would made it fairly easy for the states to take that, replicate that program, and integrate it into their websites. And that's what Maryland was based off of, and I think Maryland is really seen as the premier.
I read a lot about the Maryland situation, which is gets very high marks for its delivery of the information.
And that's one of the great things about technology is that you can easily replicate it. I mean, using open source type of concepts, you can take great examples and then replicate it in other places.
Was it ESRI who helped do the...
Yeah, I think you can go to the very end of the slides. You see... No, unfortunately, it... What we have is just states already have the technical capacity. A GIS company distributed free templates to all levels of government.
Okay.
So I don't have the exact information. I'd be happy to look that up, though, for you. Other key elements are just easy to understand format. It's important not just to have the information up on the website, but to have it in a format that is easy for the public to use and actually download then, too. And that's where people can really sort of analyze what's going on. The other key element is the mapping of all the projects. Google and other sites make it very easy for this to happen. That's what a lot of sites have, states have used as a way to track where the money's going. And if you look at what the federal government's done, they provide some great examples of this. I would encourage you all to look on our website. At the federal level, they show some Minnesota-specific information that does a phenomenal job of showing us where the money is. The last, and I think this is really critical, is the contractor information. It's important where we know who is receiving the money, and then also what the contract and bidding process was for that. And then lastly, the jobs data. And this is something that I believe MnDOT has moved in the direction of, but the rest of the states, our website does not do at all. And it's definitely an area for improvement. And then lastly, the centralization of data. You know, it's great that MnDOT is doing this, but ideally I'd love to have a lot of that MnDOT data moved over and migrated to the our website. So a citizen can go one stop and sort of see where all the stimulus money is going instead of have to navigate around to the other places. So another key element of this is, you know, taxpayers do have a right to know where this information is or how their money is being spent in an up-to-date manner. My other concern is that some of the information is not being updated as regularly as it should be, and so, again, it needs to be a priority, especially because of the audit process right now. I mean, there are significant concerns nationally about how audits are happening in the states, and oftentimes there's a huge delay in the audit process, and so we may be wasting millions of dollars, but nobody really knows about that until the money has already been wasted. Part of the reason for creating these type of sites is opening up that process, allowing citizens to review it and sort of play that auditing role. Now, I don't think it replaces an auditor in any way, but by opening this up, it allows citizens to be more involved. User-friendly, and then also the why, transparency. If you look at the second point, I think this is really important, that the more eyes watching really helps us spot errors. You know, our state employees do a phenomenal job, but they're under a tremendous amount of pressure right now. And by engaging every citizen to do that, you put more eyes on it and you reduce the potential for errors. But then also leveling the playing field for companies by making sure that all the bidding information is going up there. And then also, you know, by doing that, it helps the companies bid faster so they know, get the information in a timely manner. But then lastly, and this is what the president really said in his statement, is that it informs the public and really puts to rest sort of the public skepticism of this money being wasted.
Mr. Dean, has Common Cause or Good Jobs First done any analysis state by state of disadvantaged business participation in ARA funds yet?
We have not. I am familiar with a few organizations that are currently working on that right now. But the major issue is the money is still sort of being distributed out.
Maybe
so they have
you could share that with us because I do know that's a common concern that we are hearing. And your point, your second point or third point about that when states are sharing information openly about contracting processes, timelines, dates, who gets a contract, I think it does allow for more openness in terms of who's going to be out there bidding and what the bidding process is, just to help open that up. So, I applaud your work. I think that this is important. It's clear that, you know, others will be studying this for a long time to come, but the fact that the report came out at a point where a state like ours can make adjustments. And I think that we'll be asking for more work on this. The fact that you said if you rescored our overall website today, it would still get a 15 out of 100 is of concern.
Madam Chair. One other point is we'd be happy to work with the commissioner on this, the rest of the department of MMB on helping to improve the site. So we are happy to sort of offer those resources as we move forward. But my other hope is that this isn't just a conversation that we have around the ARA, that really this is a conversation that we started about how do we do, you know, really take the state's information and make it more open and transparent, whether that's around the procurement process. And that database was a long time in coming, and there were lots of problems with that. Again, I think that's another area where there's places for improvement and something that the state really needs to work on. And so I hope that this is just the beginning of a conversation, and as legislators, you can play a huge leadership role in moving that forward, because I think citizens are really hungry for this. We've done some surveys of citizens, and they are hungry for this type of government information, that they are interested in playing a much more active role in what's happening here at the Capitol and helping to play more of that oversight role. So I think it's needed.
Mr. Dean, I think that's very important. It's exactly why I asked the Department of Transportation if they were moving towards this model for all their information, because it seems to me if you're going to engage in these processes and doing this, why not just make it the standard policy of the state to be this open with information?
Good work, Common Cause.
Thank you very much. Thanks. And I'm sorry that it took a while to get to you. You were very efficient in your presentation, though, so we all appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right. We will be updated about when we will meet again. Thank you so much, and we are going to be adjourned.
Margaret, I understand I missed you at the picnic the other day.
Yes,